This is a rebroadcast of The Brian Lehrer Show, so don't even think about calling in. My first guest today is a chief architect of the Iraq War who tells his version of events in a new memoir. There's a lot here that's new, especially about the months leading up to the war and the months after Saddam Hussein was toppled. It comes from Douglas Feith, who was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Donald Rumsfeld. Among the revelations in this book, the existence of a Rumsfeld memo from before the war that Feith calls the Parade of Horribles that seemed to anticipate many of the worst-case scenarios that have in fact come to pass. It portrays rampant division and undermining from within the Bush administration. Colin Powell, George Tenet, Paul Bremer, Tommy Franks, General Richard Myers, Condoleezza Rice all take their hits, and Feith says the biggest mistake was maintaining an occupation government for over a year. The book is called War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism, published by HarperCollins. And Mr. Feith, thank you for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
There's so much in your book, we'll never get to all of it, so let me explore a few areas with you. First, this Rumsfeld memo that you call a parade of horribles. You called it that at the time. It was issued on October 15th, 2002, 5 months before the war began. It anticipated everything from UN rejection of the war to Iran's influence in the new Iraq to a failure to find WMDs to a draining 8 to 10 year reconstruction process. In your opinion, what should the public make of the existence of this memo?
Well, what that memo represented was an effort by Secretary Rumsfeld to bring to the president's attention the downsides of going to war. He wanted to make sure that the president understood the risks of war, having already spent a fair amount of time discussing the risks of leaving Saddam Hussein in power. I think the memo will be very surprising to people because it's completely the opposite of the image that a lot of people have of Secretary Rumsfeld and his team, which is that this was a team that was advocating war. What we were in fact doing was trying to analyze in a really serious fashion an extremely difficult problem, which was weighing the risks of leaving Saddam Hussein in power versus the risks of removing him.
Well, the public was never told that the parade of horribles were considered possibilities. Instead, we were told it would be a cakewalk. Were you...
weren't told that by the administration. Absolutely not.
Well, that particular quote came from Kenneth Edelman from Secretary Rumsfeld's advisory group, correct?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of private citizens on various advisory groups. They were not government officials. That was a very ill-considered remark.
Well, let me play you a clip of Vice President Cheney on Meet the Press from March 16th, 2003, as the war was beginning.
Now, I think things have gotten so bad inside Iraq from the standpoint of the Iraqi people. My belief is we will, in fact, be greeted as liberators.
If your analysis is not correct, then we're not treated as liberators but as conquerors, and the Iraqis begin to resist, particularly in Baghdad, do you think the American people are prepared for a long, costly, and bloody battle with significant American casualties?
Well, I don't think it's likely to unfold that way, Tim, because I really do believe we will be greeted as liberators.
So, Mr. Feith, wasn't that typical of the kind of optimism we were getting from the administration?
Well, that was certainly one of the more optimistic comments. There were also a lot of comments, especially by Secretary Rumsfeld and people at the Pentagon, that were a lot more reserved than that, and that did say that, you know, war is a very unpredictable activity, and we were very conscious of the downsides, and the fact is that as various people who've written about Iraq, the Iraq War, from, you know, position on the ground there, have said, the initial reaction of many of the Iraqis was, in fact, to greet us as liberators. One of the things that I examine in the book was how we forfeited, it was a serious policy error in my view, we forfeited our position as liberators by setting up an occupation government in Iraq. And That was not part of the original plan, but it's how things developed, and I think it was an error.
And we'll get to that, and we'll explore that in some detail, because I know you think that was such a major mistake. But staying with the Parade of Horribles memo for a minute and how specific it got, it doesn't seem to me, and we were covering it closely on this show, the debate from all points of view before the war, whether that was going to be a good thing to do, this list of possibilities that Secretary Rumsfeld was considering it possible that you wouldn't find WMDs, that it could take 8 to 10 years to reconstruct. These things, we certainly were not told that there was even a possibility considered that there were no WMDs because it was considered such a certainty.
Well, the CIA spoke categorically about this, and they said that we would find chemical and biological weapon stockpiles. And this was believed throughout the government. I'm confident that when Secretary Powell spoke to the UN and said that and reported what the CIA had said, that he was sincere and he believed it, as I think officials throughout the Bush administration believed it, as officials in the Clinton administration.
So why were you considering that as one of the possibilities that was listed in the memo?
Because the approach that Rumsfeld took consistently was to be skeptical. Rumsfeld doubted all intelligence. And he thought that it was the proper frame of mind for policy officials was always to be questioning, challenging, and skeptical.
You write that WMDs were only the fourth most important reason for the war. Do I have that right?
Well, no. What I do is I quote from a document that Condi Rice, as National Security Advisor, circulated as the statement of U.S. goals in Iraq, and the WMD point was listed as fourth. I'm not sure that one should take too much away from that, as if she was ranking them in order of importance. But they were listed in a statement of what our strategic goals were in Iraq.
In the pre-war public selling of the war, WMDs were almost the singular reason for the necessity of going to war. What were 1, 2, and 3?
Well, what I explain in the book is that there were actually a range of threats and concerns that dominated thinking about Iraq. And I discuss in the book that we even had a mnemonic for the main concerns about Iraq, and it was WMD and the three T's. And the three T's were threats to neighbors, support for terrorism, and tyranny. And when we looked at Iraq, what we saw was a regime that had been extremely aggressive and threatening and was at the time shooting at American and British pilots every day, the pilots who were patrolling the no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq. And there was concern that Saddam Hussein was dismantling the containment strategy that the UN Security Council had put in place after the Gulf War and was heading toward a confrontation with the United States at a much higher level than simply the daily shooting at our aircraft. And after 9/11, that concern became graver and more urgent in the minds of administration officials who were concerned about preventing the next 9/11 type attack on the United States.
Why didn't that concern become less urgent if the intelligence was showing that there were no operational relationships between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda was still active in Afghanistan and, for that matter, in many, many parts of the world?
What our intelligence was showing about Iraq and its connections with terrorist groups was that Iraq was supporting various terrorist groups in a range of ways, providing training, safe haven, weapons, finances.
Well, when you say a range of terrorist groups, I think this is very important to parse a little bit. Was Al-Qaeda, in any meaningful way, to your best knowledge at the time, prominent in that range of terrorist groups?
There were connections between Iraq and al-Qaeda. I don't think they were enormously significant, and that I don't think was the basis for... I don't think that was a substantial part of the rationale for the military action against Iraq. I think the public debate on this subject has been has not been accurate. There's a lot of misunderstanding and a lot that's been written on the issue of the Iraq al-Qaeda relationship. I think there's a lot of overstatement actually on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And when people say things like there was no relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda, that's not correct. George Tenet issued a public statement in October 2002 that resolved a debate within the government over what is the best information we have on the Iraq al-Qaeda relationship. Once he issued that statement in October 2002, which people can download off the internet, it was a letter that he sent to the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Once he issued that statement, I considered that the definitive statement on the subject. It, as far as I was concerned, it resolved the debate within the government. And that remains the most definitive statement on that subject.
Which was what, roughly?
Which was that Iraqi intelligence had contacts with al-Qaeda going back about 10 years. They discussed a range of things from mutual non-aggression to training to bomb making and chemical weapons, and there were a series of meetings.
And from what I've read, discussed mutual non-aggression but never agreed to it, and that series of meetings never went anywhere. Fair enough?
Well, I mean, we don't know that much about it. We know that we got these reports, and as I said, I never considered it an enormously significant element of the rationale for the war in Iraq, even though people in my office were involved in this controversy debating the CIA, but the debate was really, to my mind, more over the methodology that the CIA was using than the actual substance of the issue of the Iraq al-Qaeda relationship.
But if you didn't consider Iraq and al-Qaeda's relationship to be central to going to war, and yet you decided to make Iraq the central front in the war on terrorism, how is that the right decision?
Now, I think we're mixing up a number of different points here. The reason that we were concerned about Iraq included Iraq's general support for various terrorist groups, which was something that was of great importance and was a very sensitive issue after 9/11.
Well, let me stop you there again.
It wasn't simply that Iraq was closely tied to al-Qaeda, which it wasn't.
But various terrorist groups weren't after the United States. Al-Qaeda was. Various terrorist groups were primarily after Israel. Not a good thing, but isn't that what most of these terrorist organizations were involved with?
No, there were a number of terrorist groups that were involved in hostility to the United States and to our interests, and not just to Israel. But the analysis which I lay out in the book on the rationale for the war in Iraq, and I think what I've provided in the book is the detailed authoritative story based on documents. The actual documents that were used among the officials, the top officials of the government, to explain why we thought Iraq was a serious danger, why we thought it was a serious U.S. national security problem even before 9/11, and then how that problem got reexamined in light of 9/11. And what I use are the documents that Secretary Rumsfeld sent to Vice President Cheney and to Colin Powell and to the president and got back from them and to Condi Rice. And I recount the meetings that they had discussing the threat, and I use in my accounts of the meetings the actual notes that I took attending those meetings. And so I think if people are interested in finding out the complexity of the analysis that the government went through on why Iraq was a serious problem and why it was a serious problem throughout the 1990s and then even more serious in light of 9/11 at a time when the United States' tolerance for various kinds of national security risks went down, then my book will show you what the parties were actually saying to each other and writing to each other in those meetings.
We'll get to the biggest mistake that you say the U.S. made, maintaining an occupation for more than a year. But before we leave the parade of horribles memo behind, who saw it? Who was it distributed to?
The Secretary Rumsfeld took this memo after working it with his team to the White House, and he brought it to a National Security Council meeting. And with the president and the other members of the National Security Council, he went through it item by item.
And you wrote that it was grim reading. And yet none of these people on the National Security Council felt any obligation to the American people to publicly and prominently say, here's what could go wrong, but it's worth the risk?
Well, I don't agree with that. I think that there were various comments. You would have to go over, you know, a vast record of things that were said by the administration in different places at different times over the course of the months before the war. And I think that the idea that wars are uncertain, highly risky, and often go differently from the way people envision in advance is something that was well understood.
Douglas Feith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. His new memoir, War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. We'll continue in a minute with his description of what he thinks was the biggest mistake that the U.S. made once the war began. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Donald Rumsfeld. Douglas Feith, his new memoir, War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. And Mr. Feith, you do say the biggest mistake the U.S. made was maintaining an occupation in Iraq for more than a year. Why was it so bad?
The strategy that had been developed for Iraq was, as the president put it, a strategy of liberation, not occupation. And there had been a lot of discussion in the U.S. government of the dangers if we were seen to be an occupying power. And yet there were, and on the basis of that, my office developed a plan that would have put the Iraqis in charge of their own government quickly after the overthrow of Saddam. And it was a variation on what we did in Afghanistan, where when the United States removed the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, we did not set up an occupation government. We put Afghans in charge of their own government immediately through cooperation with the United Nations, and it was a very good model. And we wanted to do a variation of that model in Iraq. This was controversial within the U.S. government because even though there was a general agreement that it would be highly dangerous to have an occupation, the leadership at the State Department and the CIA was strongly antagonistic to the Iraqi democratic opposition, the Iraqi oppositionists who lived outside of Saddam Hussein's control. And we had this strange situation where, in particular, people at the State Department were arguing that it was important to avoid an occupation, but it was also important to avoid putting Iraq into the hands of the Iraqi oppositionists. And they did not prevail in the debates with the president before the war, and the plan that we had developed in the Pentagon was approved by the president before the war. But when Ambassador Bremer went to Iraq, he basically adopted the State Department view and wound up setting up an occupation government that lasted 14 months.
What do you think would have been different today if that had gone the other way? If you had found by the Iraqi democratic opposition, I guess you mean the exile groups out of Saddam Hussein's control, Ahmad Chalabi, who you defend at some length in the book, and others like that you would have kind of set them up as a first government? Is that how that would have worked?
Well, it wouldn't have just been the the so-called externals, the Kurdish leaders and Chalabi, Alawi, and the other leaders of the exile groups. The idea that we had is we would start with the only people that we could work with before the war, which were the Kurds and the exiles, and then rapidly expand to include the so-called internal leaders as soon as Saddam was overthrown. And those Iraqis would set up a government, again, on the model of what we did in Afghanistan, an interim government whose responsibility would be to produce a constitution and elections.
And that was the
thought that was contained in the plan that was called the Iraqi Interim Authority Plan.
So you think the fact that the United States technically, for a period of time, was an occupying force, that was seen as so unacceptable by the Iraqi people, especially Sunnis, I guess, that it helped launch the insurgency?
Well, the point that I make in the book is that the United States faced serious problems right after the overthrow of Saddam. But after the 14 months of U.S. occupation, we faced not just serious problems, but a full-blown insurgency. And I think that our establishing and running this occupation government for as long as we did, unfortunately, persuaded a number of Iraqis that the only way to get the United States out was to fight them. And that was a terrible problem for us to have. We certainly didn't want to dominate Iraq, control people's lives, and run the place as an imperial power. We were intent on removing the Saddam Hussein regime because of the threat that it posed to us, and liberating the Iraqi people along the way. And we forfeited the opportunity to consolidate our position as liberators and became tainted as the occupiers of Iraq.
You have a reputation as a pro-democracy neoconservative, but you say in the book that you argued that building a democracy was not a main reason to go to Iraq or to stay there. Can you explain your actual thinking about that?
Yes, I think that one of the things I tried to do in the book consistently was deal with what I think are major misconceptions that the public has about our policies, about the officials, about the neocons, as you correctly point out. And there is a widespread notion that I, as a neocon, and other colleagues of mine in the administration believe that we should go to war in Iraq in order to spread democracy by the sword. And that was never my view, and I don't think that was ever the view that prevailed in the administration. In fact, I do not believe, and I say so in the book and explain it, I do not believe that spreading democracy is a justification for going to war. There are lots of countries in the world that are not democracies, and we don't launch wars against them in order to create democracies.
But again, to the public selling of the war was called Operation Iraqi Freedom, as if it was for the freedom of Iraqis. Was that a bill of goods sold to the pro-democracy, pro-freedom sentiments of the American people?
No. What we had was a situation where the Iraqi regime was viewed as a serious threat to us. And the reason for the war was to deal with that threat. But it was clear that once we removed the Saddam Hussein regime, we were going to have to put some kind of government in its place. We were going to have to be responsible and not leave a mess behind. And so the idea was that we would give the Iraqis the opportunity to build democratic institutions. I mean, one way to think about it is think about World War II. We did not fight Japan and Germany in order to make them democratic. We fought them because of the threat they posed to us. But once we were in the war, and once we conquered those countries, it was quite clear that we were going to do our best to try to free the people and give them democratic government.
But nobody called World War II Operation German Freedom.
Well, the position we had toward Iraq was that we said that we do not have a quarrel with the Iraqi people. I mean, it was a different, you're correct, that it was a different, the conflict was of a different nature. And in Iraq, we said we do not have a quarrel with the Iraqi people. We have a quarrel with their regime. And so in overthrowing that regime, we're going to be providing the Iraqi people freedom. But it was quite clear that the motive for this war was to deal with the threat from the Saddam Hussein regime. And it was not an experiment in spreading democracy by the sword. And we opposed that. And one of the things that the book does, which I think is quite interesting and it will surprise readers, is it explains how the democracy rhetoric in the administration was debated, and it was actually Secretary Rumsfeld and myself who took a leading role in trying to tone down the democracy rhetoric so that we could be clearer within our own councils of government and with the public that we were not launching a war for the purpose of doing a political experiment in the Middle East. We had come to the conclusion that war was necessary because of the national security threats posed by the Saddam Hussein regime.
So do you think then that against your advice, higher-ups in the administration did engage in obfuscation to the American people to make it look like it was a war about freedom?
No, I don't think it was See, you're ascribing, nasty motives. I don't think it was a matter of nasty motives. I think that there was no... It was obvious that if we were going to go to war, and the purpose of the war was to remove the Saddam Hussein regime, it was obvious that we were going to be making an effort to help the Iraqis establish free government and a free society after the removal of Saddam. So there was no... It was a matter of what is the clearest way of talking about the war. It wasn't a matter of dishonesty or obfuscation. It was a matter of analysis and emphasis. And I think everything that people were talking about was sincere, but it was a matter of what was the clearest and most proper thing to discuss at a given time. I mean, the idea that, for example, before the war, it was clear that the project was to remove the regime, and I think it should have been clear that we were emphasizing the dangers that the regime posed. After Saddam was removed, there was no question that a major activity of the United States was to help the Iraqis create democracy. We just thought that it should be absolutely clear that the motive for the war was not to spread democracy. I mean, another analogy that I think is somewhat useful is in the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln did not launch the Civil War to free the slaves. He launched the Civil War to preserve the Union, and he would not have supported launching the war to free the slaves. But once he was in the war, he decided it was clear that he had to free the slaves. Now, somebody could say that was obfuscation. He really launched the war to free the slaves, but he denied it.
But part of the neoconservative philosophy, if I understand it correctly, is that by launching a democracy in Iraq as a central goal in the interest of the United States, not the Iraqi people necessarily, it would become contagious in the region, and all these bad regimes would fall, like the bad regimes of the Soviet bloc fell, and that would very much construe to the benefit of the United States over time. Was that not a central reason? Because we heard that a lot, too.
Well, you're quite right that you heard it a lot, and it's another example of something that has an important element of truth but is commonly misunderstood. What you said, I think, is absolutely correct, and I analyze it in the book where I say I think the United States actually has an interest in the spread of democracy, and I lay out the kind of argument that you're talking about there that explains why the United States has an interest in the spread of democracy and how the spread of democracy could actually help us counter Islamist extremism and help us in the broader war on terrorism. All of that, I think, is true, even though spreading democracy as such is not a proper reason to go to war and was not the reason we went to war in Iraq. In other words, it's again...
But if we just go around toppling governments for our own benefit or our own safety without being concerned about democracy for the people, then what are we morally? Aren't we just an empire?
No, I didn't say we're not concerned. I think you're homing in here on what I think is an extremely important distinction. I believe we are concerned about the people, and we do have an interest in the spread of democracy. I just don't think that spreading democracy as such is a justification for war. We would not have gone to war in Iraq merely because the Iraqi regime was a tyranny. If it didn't threaten us, if it didn't have the history of, you know, launching wars, attacking its neighbors, threatening us, being hostile to us, fighting the United Nations, defying, you know, the 16 Security Council resolutions that had been created to try to contain them, and all of that, the mere fact that Iraq was a tyranny would not have triggered the war. And that doesn't mean that we're indifferent. I mean, I think the United States cares about, for example, I mean, we care about other people living in tyranny in various places, but we're not launching wars all over the world to liberate them.
Douglas Fyfe, my guest for just another few minutes here on WNYC, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and now the author of a memoir called War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. So from that, let me jump to the present and get your opinion of what to do now in Iraq, and specifically, how do you define victory?
I think that as I lay out in the book, it's important that we have a realistic and modest statement of what a victory or a significant accomplishment would be. And we went to war in order to get rid of a regime that pursued weapons of mass destruction and had used them, and that supported terrorists, that threatened its neighbors and tyrannized its people. If we have an Iraq that doesn't do any of those things and that has a government that can handle the ongoing problems of the country largely on its own, if it has a government that has capacity to deal with the ongoing problems of Iraq with a minimum amount of outside support, and that minimum amount the United States can help contribute to but would not be an ongoing commitment of combat forces, I think that would be a significant achievement for the United States, to have removed a regime that posed all those threats, replaced it with a government that doesn't pose any of those threats. I think the world would appreciate that it is a lot better off without the Saddam Hussein regime.
But how do you quantify it going forward? Because after General Petraeus' testimony last week, it sounds like, if you think this is a fair characterization, that the next president will probably have a sort of stalemate on his or her hands, a pause in the troop drawdown, a quieter Iraq than before the surge, but not quiet enough to pull out, at least as this administration sees it. So the question will be, how much instability, because it won't be zero, how much Iranian influence, because it certainly won't be zero, how much al-Qaeda activity isn't worth the American lives to be risked anymore, you know, not whether there is zero, because there will never be zero of any of those three things. So can you quantify it?
Well, I think you're correct that those problems are not going to go down to zero. The issue is, can the problems be contained while the capacity of the Iraqi government is increased? And you get to the point where the capacity of the Iraqi government is sufficient to handle those problems, mm-hmm, without the United States playing a combat role.
But then by almost any measure, al-Qaeda, in as messy a country as Iraq, will have more of a base of operations today than they did before the war. No?
No, not at all. I mean, the goal is that we can take advantage of some of the recent trends where the Sunni Arabs in Iraq changed their strategy. They had been allying with al-Qaeda and fighting the Americans, and some months ago, they decided that that was a bad strategy for them. And as you know, they shifted, and now they're allying with the United States and the Iraqi government, and they're fighting al-Qaeda. And the goal is that they will deny al-Qaeda the safe haven and the opportunity to operate in Iraq. And that's what General Petraeus was basically reporting about as one of the positive developments.
That's
irreversible,
yeah,
but it is a positive development.
But that's the goal, even if the Sunnis stay non-aligned or no longer aligned with al-Qaeda. which is another Sunni group. It's still questionable how much military power they'll have. We're running out of time. I just want to ask you on that, sort of on this point, do you think McCain and the Democrats will be much different on war policy once they are in office, regardless of their campaign rhetoric now? And for that matter, do you see Clinton and Obama as actually acting differently in office from each other if one of them were to get in?
Well, it's a tremendously interesting point that I think you're highlighting, and it's something that I deal with in the book, and that is there is actually an extraordinary amount of common ground and continuity in American national security policy, even though when we get into political campaigns, everybody likes to emphasize that they're at polar opposites from each other, that they are polar opposites of each other. It's really not the case. And I think that something that is helpful to the country, and I tried to write the book as a demonstration of this, is that we actually have in America an amazing amount of common ground. And as somebody once put it, we tend to fight out our political battles within the 40-yard lines. And that's what makes America a happy and healthy country. And it would be a good thing if the rhetoric that is used for debating these issues recognized that, and we had a kind of stronger sense of community, which the rhetoric denies. But the reality is, I think that there will be a lot of continuity in national security policy in general, even though there are some important differences between the parties. Those important differences are not polar opposites. And I think that any government will have major responsibilities to take care that Iraq doesn't become a complete disaster with collapse.
We have to leave it there. Douglas Feith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. His new book, War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism, published by HarperCollins. Thank you very much.
Thank you.